Hello, and welcome to another episode of Famous Failures, where I interview the world's most interesting people about the failures they've had in their lives and what they learned from them. I'm your host, Ozan Morol. Before I introduce today's guest, I have a request from you. The podcast is fairly new, so I would really appreciate your help in spreading the word. You can do that in one of three ways. You can tell your friends about the podcast, you can subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform that you're listening on, or you can leave a review on iTunes or Google Play. In addition, if you'd like to keep in touch with me and say hello to me, you can subscribe to my weekly newsletter, The Weekly Contrarian. It has thousands of subscribers, and readers call it the one email I look forward to each week. So every Thursday, you'll get a list of tools, articles, books, and other gems that challenge conventional wisdom and change the way that you look at the world. You can sign up for that by going to my website, ozanmorol.com, or texting my first name, Ozan, O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. And if you sign up now, you'll also get a free ebook called The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles for Innovating Your Thinking. And again, you can get that right now on the go by texting O-Z-A-N to 345-345 or heading over to my website, ozanmorol.com. On this episode, I speak with Hank Weisinger. Hank is a world-renowned psychologist and pioneer in the field of pressure management. He is a 2-time New York Times bestselling author. He has consulted with and developed programs for dozens of Fortune 500 companies and government agencies. He has taught in executive education and executive MBA programs at schools like UCLA, NYU, Wharton, Cornell, and MIT. He has appeared on The Today Show, he's appeared on Oprah, and he was also featured in the New York Times Sunday business section. His latest book is called Performing Under Pressure, The Science of Doing Your Best When It Matters Most. So in the episode, we begin with the book. Hank will introduce us to the concept of pressure management, and he'll offer specific solutions, really practical solutions, to help you overcome the debilitating effects of pressure, to help you reduce pressure in both your personal and professional lives so you can excel in whatever you do. Once we've covered the book and those practical strategies, we then transition into Hank's failures. Without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Hank Weisinger. So you've written a number of bestsellers on diverse subjects, from giving criticism to anger management to emotional intelligence, and finally to performing under pressure. How do you decide what topic to pursue?
I decide on the topic through my observations that I see things happening, interactions. I see, as a clinician, areas that people have difficulty in. For example, back in 1976, I was working in a mental health center as a graduate student. I like to qualify that so people don't think I was working in a mental health center as a patient. Sitting in a room with a bunch of my fellow students, a psychiatrist walked in and in broken English started criticizing a friend of mine who was becoming a social worker. And this is not an exaggeration. It went on for about 15, 20 minutes until she started to cry. She got up, walked out of the room, and the psychiatrist said, "See, she doesn't even realize when she's getting defensive." And he had no awareness of how he was coming across. And right there, it dawned on me, because at that time, assertiveness was the hot subject. Everybody was doing assertive training. And I see this experience happen in front of me. And I say, boy, how many people can really handle criticism? It was right in front of me. And then I just started thinking about it. And I started listening more effectively to my clients. And I would see, especially with marriage counseling, how many would have trouble criticizing each other. That was it. So it was like an observation. When I was doing my internship at the Brentwood VA in Los Angeles, I had a patient come in and he was getting out of the hospital. And I told him, "You have 3 minutes to call your mother in Brooklyn and tell her you are getting out," which should be a happy thing. And without the speakerphone, as soon as he said to his mother, "I'm leaving the hospital," she started bombarding him. "You're sick. Are they crazy? You can't live on your own." He literally started, quote, choking in front of me. I had to take the phone away, and there it was in the back of my mind, performing under pressure. So I see clinical observations. It's not like I have a line of research and I'm going to develop that. Thinking in topics is fueled by the clinical experiences that I see unfolding and happen in front of me. I worked with a lot of VA guys who were coming back from Vietnam. First ward in the country, 1976, that was designed exclusively for Vietnam veterans. So I saw that one problem they had, managing anger. And right there in the back of my mind, I tucked it away, anger management. And that was way before it was a movie. So I pick my topics out of the difficulties that people have in everyday life.
It sounds like you begin with empirical observation and then you build a theory and come up with an idea for a book from there.
Exactly. In many ways, that's how Freud and I were very similar. He'd see these clinical experiences in front of him and then start to figure it out. And I would say that I do the same thing. Somebody can't say to me, hey, why don't you write a book on this subject or whatever? And there's a million good topics, but if it's not meaningful to me, then I can't do it. I can't do what in the publishing world is called a cash-in. Cash in on the success of your other book just by writing on any subject. I don't want to do that. Then it's grunt work. So when the best part of writing a book for me is the thinking about it and developing the idea. Ironically, the best book I ever wrote was probably the least successful book called The Genius of Instinct. And I will say it was the first book to exploit, for want of a better word, evolutionary psychology, which now in academics is probably the hardest type of PhD program to get into. I got very much into the subject of evolutionary psych. The idea of the book was we're hardwired to be successful. That's what your instincts do. They're not dark and primitive like animal behavior, but they're problem-solving tools. The only reason you have your instincts is they help you survive. And I went, like, breathing is an instinct. I would always say to people, go home, sit in your tub, and try to drown yourself. You can't do it. You'll put your head underwater until you have to breathe, and then your head pops up. But that's a survival instinct. And what I noticed, the more I read, is we have certain instincts that help us thrive, and most people do not use them. So the idea of the book became, why are we disconnected from these instincts that help us thrive? This is why the average person is surviving. You know, how are you doing? Oh, I'm getting by, taking one day at a time. And according to the President of the United States, America is not thriving. Other countries are thriving more than us. And that concept was the most original concept I ever had. It was the most fun. And one of the chapters was on your curiosity instinct. Now, there's an old expression about curiosity killed the cat, but satisfaction brought him back. Now, how many lives does a cat have?
9.
Exactly. So to do that chapter, I came up with 9 ways of how to use the curiosity instinct in contemporary living. How to use the curiosity instinct, for example, to improve your sex life. How to use the curiosity instinct to help your senior parents feel like they are young again, and so on. Every book I do is structured in a different way. That's the creative aspect of it. You could give me great subjects, and that's what a professional writer does. That's the difference. I am not a professional writer. I am a psychologist, and I don't think of myself as a professional writer. That's why I hate writing. Now, my father was a writer. What he's written, you've seen on TV. What he's written, you've probably read growing up or seen in the movies. He was a professional writer. He loved writing. I love the thinking and the promoting and the marketing, because you get to be a little creative, but the actual grunt work of running it through the typewriter, as an editor would say, that is something I detest.
Yeah, it certainly can be a painful experience, and I enjoy writing, but there are days when, you know, it's 9 a.m. and you have to knock out 500 words and they just don't come. I can certainly relate to that.
Very hard. The one thing about being a psychologist is I knew how to motivate myself, you know, because, you know, as you're pointing out, now some people do delegate. Some people have. I'm sure there are many bestsellers on the New York Times that were written by somebody else. I mean, do you really think that the CEO of a company is going to spend the time writing his own book? Unless it's a memoir, do you think they're really going to spend time on a how-to book? There's not a chance. So they get somebody else, you know, to write it. I mean, if you have a good agent, they have a list of writers that they will give you to help. Agents love that because then they're getting it from both ends.
I'd love to talk about your latest book a little bit, Performing Under Pressure, The Science of Doing Your Best When It Matters Most. Let's suppose you're advising someone who's about to walk into a high-pressure job interview. What advice would you give them?
Well, when my daughter or my son would go for a interview, I would tell them as one strategy is to hum a song all the way up to their first question that they are asked. Do you know why?
I don't. Why?
Because one of the reasons people do poorly in a pressure situation, which we need to define in a minute, is they get distracting thoughts. And those distracting thoughts cause the person to lose focus. They start thinking things like, what if I don't get this job? I wonder what the other person said in the interview. Are they going to, am I dressed appropriately? What will they think? And before you know it, as soon as the first question's asked, you start to stutter because you're not focused. So studies have shown that people in a pressure situation, when they hum a song, singing it is actually better if you know the lyrics, are less distractible and become more focused. I would tell the person, if you tell me that you have a big interview tomorrow morning, you know, or a big sales presentation, and I don't care how hokey this sounds, but if you write down your anxieties the night before and your fears, you end up doing better in the pressure situation. And the reason is you've gotten those thoughts out of your system so that they are less likely to surface. I might tell my son or daughter to remember there's always another interview. One of the things that happens in a pressure situation that increases the feelings of pressure that make you do worse is when you think of it as a do or die situation, a chance of a lifetime, when a better strategy is to think of multiple opportunities. So I would tell listeners, and no matter what the situation is, always think that you're going to get another chance. Students need to know this. There's always another test. If you think back to high school and college, you know, many students get in the framework, this is the most important test of my life, the most important. Obviously, that creates a lot of pressure. As a rule of thumb, the more important you make something, the more pressure you experience. And nobody does better under pressure. And let me say what a pressure situation is, because you said, you know, you have a big interview. Okay. A pressure moment is when you go into a situation that you have a lot on the line. In other words, it's important to you, and the outcome is dependent on your performance. That's what a pressure moment is. So when a baseball player goes up and bases are loaded and there's two outs, yeah, it's a pressure situation because the outcome is dependent on his performance. If you knew were guaranteed that you're getting a hit, then there's no pressure. This is why when a student who is locked into an A and then they have to take another test, they're not feeling any pressure because the outcome is irrelevant. So if you're watching a World Cup soccer game and your team is down by 5 goals and there's 30 seconds left, do you really have to watch the last 30 seconds? You can turn it off because there's no way your team is winning. On the other hand, if it's 30 seconds left, penalty kick for your team, you're on the edge of your seat if that kick can win the game because the outcome is uncertain. Remember, uncertainty is another word for anxiety. So by definition, anytime somebody goes into a pressure situation, they are going to experience anxiety. Anxiety impedes performance. Therefore, your pressure management strategies are geared towards reducing that feeling of anxiety, substituting it with feelings of confidence and optimism so you can do better in the moment. And when I say better, your best might not be good enough. That's what people never want to acknowledge. You know, if you see two soccer teams play and the final score is 1-0, the team that lost is not, they're going to feel bad that they lost, but not ashamed because they didn't blow anything. That's when you hear them say, they just played better than us. That is very different then the goalie letting a slow ball go through his legs as a score because he's thinking of what he has to do later that evening.
Is there a difference between a stressful situation and a pressure situation, the way you define the term?
Yes, there's a big difference between stress and pressure. And most people confuse the two. And when you do, you create havoc in your life because you are on high alert 24/7. You are treating every stressful moment, and I'll differentiate in a sec, you're making every stressful moment a do-or-die situation. And that is a pressure moment. Now, a good way to put it is to ask a person, who would you rather be married to, stress or pressure? Now, if you're married to stress, what you're going to hear your partner say is, do this, do this, do this, do this. And when you are done with doing all that, you're going to hear, now do this. In other words, stress is when you have demands made upon you and you do not necessarily have the resources to respond. If you have too many bills and not enough money, then you experience financial stress. There are many ways to deal with having too many demands. I can get a secretary and delegate. I can prioritize. I can blow some of the things off. I can tell a joke. The problem is if I land a plane on the Hudson River, I can tell a joke, but I still have to land the plane. So if you're married to stress, you're just constantly being told, you got to do this, you got to do this. Now, pressure is a little different. And also remember, stress sometimes can help you. Stress sometimes can motivate you. A manager who has a, quote, lazy staff can stress them out, i.e. put more demands upon them, and they will become more productive up to a point. Because if you have too many demands, then your performance, you know, the stress will cause you to do worse because you can't do everything. And then it becomes physically exhausting. Pressure is a little different. The evolutionary function of pressure is to get rid of you, to weed you out. If you're married to pressure, it's going to be like this. You better do this, and you better not fail. Because if you fail, you are out. What happened to the students at Cornell that could not stand the academic pressure? They're gone. What happens to the financial advisors if after 2 years they can't handle the pressure? They are gone. What happens to a soccer team in the World Cup if they can't handle the pressure? They are gone. So pressure weeds you out. Where do you think the expression do or die came from? It wasn't an ESPN analyst making it up, because for early man, you're dead. The goal of pressure is to produce a successful response. You want to reduce the feelings of stress. When a person is stressed, the subjective feelings tend to be exhaustion, tension, anger. With pressure, the subjective feelings are more of fear, anxiety, and embarrassment if you fail. So I like to teach people that whenever you think you are in a pressure situation, ask yourself, do I have to perform a particular task? Do I need to be successful? Or do I just have a lot of demands made upon me? If the answer is the latter, then you have options. Take a deep breath, relax for a while, take a break, delegate, do it tomorrow. You have many, many ways. Manage your time more effectively. And if you have to perform, then that tells you just focus on your task and do your best.
I'd love to switch now to talking about your failures. So you've had many, many, many accomplishments in your life, but what have been some of the most valuable failures and what makes them valuable?
You know, some people define we'll say when you ask that question, they'll say, oh, the biggest failure I ever had is when I wrote this TV show and I thought it was great, but the network didn't like it. That's a joke. That's not a failure for the average person. People don't realize that's like a producer or a director saying, biggest failure I ever had was this last movie I did. Maybe to a director, but the reality is it is so hard to make a movie. Just getting it on the screen is a success. So to actually think of that as a human failure, to me, is ridiculous. It's like an author saying, Oh, my fifth book was the biggest failure. It was only on the New York Times for a week. It was so disappointing. These are not failures. And then the person makes a big deal of how, but I learned from it. I embraced it. And then I wrote another successful book or another TV show. That is giving such false information, the real world on what a failure is. There's no shame in that. That's not something that you want to hide from your friends. So when you say to me, what's my biggest failure? I would say all through high school, that every day when I think of my grades, and how I interacted with people, that was a big failure. I graduated from my class out of 449 students from a very prestigious public high school in Great Neck, Long Island, where all my friends were going to Ivy League schools. I graduated 20th from the bottom. That, I would say, was not the failure per se, but the failure was that all through those 4 years of high school, I never got it. I never realized that maybe I should be studying and educating myself. And then I went to all sorts of ways. I didn't want to tell my friends that I was getting D's and so on. It would be embarrassing. So I never showed them my report card. I made believe I had better grades. I wasn't being honest. That's another failure. I would say my biggest failure at that point was not being honest with my parents. They're both gone now. My parents were my best friends. That's the biggest thing I regret. So I would say that was a really big personal failure, and it impacted me because it altered my life. And when I had to deal with the consequences of going to a school as a undergraduate that was only accredited in the state of New Hampshire, that was a big lesson. The lesson was, I didn't do my best.
So how did you go from performing poorly in high school to then, you know, getting a PhD in psychology?
First of all, people like me usually don't get PhDs. That's what makes it more amazing. The typical person like who you might have on this who has a PhD and teaches at an Ivy League school was basically an obsessive person all through high school. They made studying the most important thing. They did extracurricular activities and all that stuff. I was never that type of person. So what turned me around is I took a psychology course as an undergraduate, and the teacher inspired me, and I studied, and I got the highest mark on the class, and it was the first time I ever got or experienced academic success. So I became a psychology major. And what that links in, the timing, and it has to be right. People get motivated. People listening to this need to know you get motivated at different times. And it has to resonate. You have to find something that is meaningful. The message that I have given my nephew, who is now a physician, he said the only thing that I ever said to him that made sense. Now, I've said a lot of things because he went to Michigan, and I will tell you, I've explained how Michigan can never be a championship football team or basketball team. I said a lot of important things to him. He just didn't want to hear that. But what he did hear was figure out what you like to do, and then you can figure out how to make money at it. And that is the same message to my kids. That's how you can really, many ways, not deal with a sense of failing. People tend to fail a lot of things that they really don't like doing also. You know, I would tell people, make a list of your goals. But the list should be goals you've accomplished and goals you didn't accomplish. You gave up on them. Why'd you give up on them? I was going to write a book, for example, called The Emotionally Intelligent Nurse, because I was thinking of it from a business point of view. You know what? Make this book 100 pages, and every nursing school in the country, in the world, will get this book. Every nurse needs this book and so on. But how could I do it? Because it was grunt work. It wasn't meaningful to me. I had already written The Emotionally Intelligent Financial Advisor and The Emotionally Intelligent Real Estate Agent. So now I'm going to do another one, The Emotionally Intelligent Nurse, same information, change the word advisor to nurse and grunt it out. I can't do that. And nobody should do something that they don't like. Having a job that you don't like is the worst punishment. I wouldn't even wish that on my enemies. That's terrible. So I was lucky that I found psychology interesting. I got academic success, and then the rest became history. Then it became easy. Because if you're interested in something, nobody has to tell you to do it. Nobody has to tell you to do what you find interesting. And then you become more and more competent. See, that's how to make curiosity work for you, that to follow your interests. What you see today, I remember I graduated from high school in the 60s. So the three big choices is you had to either be a doctor, a lawyer, or an accountant. That would be low on the totem pole. I couldn't do any of those things. I wasn't interested in those. I was an accounting major my first year. You know how ridiculous? Because my father said he majored in accounting. I had a summer job, talk about failures, in a company. It was called, I think, Shoemaker. It was big in the carpet business. And I got the job through an employment agency. And they stuck me in accounting with like six other people. I was low man on the totem pole, which meant that I had to go out and get them coffee and donuts in the morning. Now, for me, that was a totally degrading experience. And talk about failure. And remember in the old days, without computers, they give you that whiteout where if you make a mistake, you put the whiteout on? Are you too young to remember that?
Yeah, I remember that very clearly.
All right. So by the end of the first week, my ledger had whiteout all over it because I kept putting in the wrong numbers. This was the most boring possible thing I could ever do. Then the second lowest guy gets a promotion. Then they call me in, and I'm thinking, oh, great, they're going to bump me up. I'll get his job. And the guy said, how do you think you're doing? And I said, oh, I think I'm really doing really well. Well, we don't think you're doing too good. We're going to let you go on Friday.
And was a summer job during college or high school?
No, it was a summer job before I went to college.
Okay.
And then my next summer job was working at Tiffany's, the jewelry store on 57th and 5th. I did that for 3 years, and I did well, and I worked my way up. And it was because it was much more interesting. I got to see all the customers come in, make my own clinical observations. Here comes a 70-year-old guy walking in with a 25-year-old model type. They buy him a pair of cufflinks, and then they buy her diamonds. I find that entertaining. And I like all the other guys. They were all from a different social class, is the way to put it. I mean, they used to flip out when they would. They'd say, why are you working? Because they'd see my father drop me off in a big white Cadillac every morning and pick me up. But I was interested in it. So if you do well, if you're interested in something, it makes it easier to do well. Follow your interests. It's an important message for parents with their kids. You know, encourage their interests. And unfortunately, what happens is that many parents, if they're not interested in it, they don't let their kid be in it. You know something? One of my closest friends, his kid played video games all day. And most parents would say no. Bottom line, the kid ended up writing a book when he was 15, published, called Video Programming for the Evil Genius. He taught kids how to beat the video games. Then he went to MIT, graduated in 3 years. He's at Stanford Business School right now, finding it rather simplistic academically. They encouraged his interest.
What you mentioned with respect to doing something you like, I think also ties into if you enjoy something, and I certainly see this with my own work, if I enjoy something, it becomes so much more easier for me to focus on the process as opposed to outcome. And if you focus on outcomes, then, you know, we sort of get into this high-pressure situation that you talked about before. But if you're getting intrinsic pleasure and motivation from the process itself, regardless of what happens with the outcome, then life becomes much more interesting.
Yes, and you have made another good point as it applies to performing under pressure, is that one of the reasons people do poorly in a pressure situation is they are focused on the outcome. And if you're thinking about the outcome, it takes you out of the moment. I'm watching the Winter Olympics, and I hear this guy saying, and this was just like the last time, and he said, well, I've had a great year, you know, in skiing, but if I don't win the gold, it's been a wasted, you know, wasted year. This is what it's all about. And I'm saying to myself, this guy is going to choke because he's thinking about the medal rather than what he needs to do. And as he's coming down the hill, all of a sudden, what happens? He stumbles. It's like I called it because I knew where his thoughts were. So when you say, what can you do? Another thing that you can do in a pressure moment is to focus on your breathing and regulate your breathing, because that is a very easy way to stay in control of yourself by focusing on your breathing. And it keeps you in the moment. I tell my kids that when you have an interview, make sure you are really listening to what the person says, not thinking of your response. but listening to them and looking at them. That's like telling a golfer when you're walking down the fairway, instead of thinking about your Nike contract or the next match or whether you're going to win or lose, is to focus on how beautiful it is outside and your breathing, because it keeps you in the present moment. So it's very important. And remember about anxiety. Anxiety is about the future. It's not about the present. Anxiety is uncertainty about what is going to happen. That's why if you've seen a scary movie, you're on the edge of your seat, you don't know the end. But after you've seen it 20 times, you still enjoy watching it, but you're not anxious because you know what is coming. This is probably why people say that they don't like surprises.
You mentioned focus on breathing and being in the present moment as a way of coping with a high-pressure situation. What are your thoughts on meditation?
It's in my book as a pressure solution, very important. Actually, they have it down to 12 hours of meditation. It actually makes changes in your brain. People should not think of it as meditation, because in order to do that, what are the things you have to do? Well, one is you have to focus on your breathing. You're basically relaxing yourself. It's the components of the meditation that work, not the meditating per se, because you're doing certain things like you are relaxing, like you're learning how to stay focused in your thinking. So it's really the components, but that would be considered, you know, if you practice it, it will help you. It's also having the mindset. You know, the most important thing between people who perform closer to their capabilities and people who perform below their capabilities when they want to do their best is your perception of the situation. In other words, if you see the situation as threatening, you're going to do worse. If you see the situation as an opportunity, as fun, as a challenge, you will do better. So you have to befriend the moment rather than be overwhelmed by the moment. That was true 10,000 years ago. It is true today. A student who's taking a test and sees that, I can lock up my A in the semester. I can really show my stuff on this. I can't wait to take that test. Versus the student who sees it as a threatening experience. Oh, if I don't pass, I'm going to fail out and whatever. That makes a huge difference. And also, as I said earlier, you have to think in terms of multiple opportunities. You know, I was giving a talk one time at a leadership conference in Canada. It was for financial advisors. There must have been about 500 in the room. So this one young guy gets up. I pegged him at about 24. And he says, how do you deal with the pressure of calling a girl that you like for the first time? That's a lot of pressure for me. He says, how do I handle that? Before I could respond, another gentleman, about 28, I'd say, a few years older, jumps up. And before I could say anything, he says, just remember that there's 1,000 other girls waiting for the same phone call. Now, everybody laughed, but everybody knew it was true. So always to be thinking, there's another opportunity, because once you think of multiple opportunities, it is no longer a do or die situation. A third part of that mental set is downside the importance. This is hard for a lot of people to do. It's counterintuitive for a manager to say, you know, it's just another project, when in reality, everybody knows, you know, our whole division is depending on this. But that's the choking strategy. Joe Flacco said the day before the Super Bowl, which he was the winning quarterback, Joe, how do you handle the pressure of the game, Super Bowl? He said, it's just another game. Now, the media hates that. How can you say it's just another game? You know, it's the Super Bowl and so on. But that's the attitude that allows him to do well, to downsize the importance. See, it's counterintuitive for parents to say, don't worry about your SATs. It's just another test. But that's the attitude that's going to help your kid do the best. Versus, this is the most important test you're ever going to take. Yeah, until the next one. Also, to anticipate. You know, one of the ways that I see myself very similar to Tom Brady is we both anticipate. What could happen? He's anticipating the defense. You know, you're talking about writing a book. Anticipate all the obstacles. And then when those obstacles come your way, you maintain your composure because you have anticipated them and you know how to deal with them. What anticipation does, it allows you to keep your composure when things go wrong. Many times in sports, a golfer makes a bad shot or two, and you hear the announcer say he's lost his composure, and then it's downhill from there. But if you anticipate you're going to make a bad shot and get in the mindset, okay, now how do I deal with it? Then when it happens, you are still in control. Perception of control is very important in dealing with pressure productively. That the people who can feel as though they are in control of the situations are the ones who are confident. It's when you lose control or you think you're out of control is when things really start to go downhill.
That makes sense. Your point about anticipation reminded me of a story I heard when I was in law school. The current Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, John Roberts, he was an advocate before the Supreme Court and argued many, many, many cases. And I remember watching a clip of an interview with him, and he talked about his preparation for oral argument. And, you know, from an attorney's perspective, this is a high-pressure situation. You've got nine justices, nine of the brightest legal minds in the country, throwing curveballs at you. And one of the ways that he dealt with it was to write out, I think, hundreds of questions, if I'm remembering this correctly, but hundreds of questions in advance. So he was ready for pretty much every question that could possibly come from the bench. And so when you observe him in oral arguments, or you listen to one of the recordings, he's so composed and so in control of the situation, in part because he did exactly what you just talked about, which is to anticipate what might happen.
Exactly. It's the same thing in the finance world. When they give the financial advisor who's cold calling how to overcome objections, they give you a book. Here's every objection you're going to hear. Oh, I don't have the money. I'd have to check with my wife. I'm not into the market now, and so on. So you know all of those. No matter what the person says, you are ready. As a therapist, that's much of becoming an effective therapist, is overcome the objections, i.e. the resistance of the patient. So when you anticipate those things in advance, what if they do this? What if they do that? Obviously, you are more prepared. See, preparation is still the best strategy for dealing with a pressure moment. Practice, practice, practice. And yet, you will see that many people, I practiced my audition, you know, my violin solo a million times, then I get up on the stage and I choke. And that's where the distracting thoughts start to come in. Because now, instead of just doing what I'm doing automatically, I start thinking, am I holding my violin right? Do I have the bow right? Am I doing this right? So you're trying to control what you do automatically. For example, I assume you drive, correct?
Yes.
Now, do you remember when you were first learning how?
I do.
Describe the procedure of what you would do when you got into your car, like when you were that first week of learning how to drive.
Well, I would open the door, get in, check my mirrors probably, make sure that they're all aligned correctly, adjust my seats, make sure I can reach the pedals fine, put in the key, turn the ignition, look behind me very carefully to make sure there's no one there, and start driving.
Okay, so you had sort of had like a mental checklist, is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's
right. You were very conscious?
That's right.
Yeah. Now, when you get in your car later today, you're not going through that checklist.
No, because I've done it thousands of times, right?
Exactly. You know, when I scrape my car, when I start paying attention, inching out of my car, looking on both sides and in back of me, it's like, why is a golfer thinking about their stroke that they practice 10,000 times?
Right.
And that's what happens. That's one of the reasons that people, you know, choke. And remember what choking is. Choking is suboptimal performance when you want to do your best. So if you don't really care about the outcome and you do poorly, that's not a choke. You don't care. You know, it's like if I'm playing a friend and I don't really care, you know, like when about my basketball shooting, that's not a choke if I lose. I don't care. So when a team, you know, has already ahead by 20 games, they've already clinched their head, and then they lose to a terrible team, that's not a choke. They didn't care. That's like the A student. I got a D on the chemistry test. Yeah, I'm already locked in for an A. I didn't even study for it, and I still passed. That's not a choke. And the other thing about choking is that you have to be able to do the behavior. Otherwise, it's not a choke. I laugh. I don't play golf, but when I'm out in California and my friend plays and I go to his club for, you know, just to watch him. When he misses a 3-foot putt and he says, "Oh, I choked," I'm laughing to myself. I have to explain to him, you're not good enough to choke. You can't make a 3-foot putt 100 times in a row. Phil Mickelson can. When a pro misses it, that's a choke, because they can do that, you know, all the time. So people need to remember that, you know, all these weekend golfers, because they all think they're really great golfers when they forget they're not really good in the first place. So how could it be a choke?
Have you choked in your life, given your definition of the term?
I have. When I was in graduate school, I choked on my comprehensive exams. The question, I still remember the question, compare and contrast 3 different theories of personality, and then they would give you like 5 parameters, you know, like research, free will, and determinism, and so on. So they gave you those 5 things. Now, my choke came in that I was so anxious, I ended up comparing and contrasting 6 different personalities on 10 different things, because I wanted to show them how much I know. When I went over the exam, one of my advisors said, he said, "You know what? This typically happens to students who get really anxious. And so you have no boundaries. You're just writing and writing and writing. And you're not answering the question." He said, "You didn't even answer the question." And that was like a major choke. And I had to take that question over again. And next time it didn't happen, because I remember, you know, another precious solution, which is focus on the mission. And all that was answer the questions. You know, and I see a big mistake is one coach will say to his team, "Just focus on winning." Wrong. The other coach will say, "Just focus on doing your best." Serena Williams says her mission when she plays a tournament is the same all the time. And then I would say to the class, "What do you think that is?" And everybody would say, "To win." And I say, "No, it's to do her best." Because she knows if she does her best 95% of the time, she will win. So that's a big difference, again, in the mental framework. The mission should never be for a student to get an A. The mission should do his best. Now, if an A student does his best, typically they get an A. But I don't want them thinking about that, because then that moves it into the outcome.
Maria Sharapova says the same thing. She describes it as the biggest failure that beginning tennis players make is a focus on outcome. And she talks about how if you focus on process and perfecting the process, the outcome will eventually come.
Exactly. And if it doesn't, it doesn't. But then you still feel good about yourself because you've done your best. That's all you can do. You know, one of the myths is that people rise to the occasion. That is not true. There's no such thing as clutch. Nobody rises to the occasion. The C student is never getting perfect SAT scores unless they cheat. But many times the A student will fold. So what I learned is that the edge is not rising to the occasion. The edge is not doing worse. So it's like when I give a presentation, I remember one time I was speaking to a major insurance company. I don't want to mention its name, but we'll just say that it was in Hartford, Connecticut. The referral question was, "We have a new vice president here, and they're putting a lot of pressure on their people, and it's having a negative effect." So I said, "Okay." So I come in, and the first thing she says to me is, "Oh, I've heard great things about you. Let's see if you can, hit the mark," whatever. And as soon as she said that, I thought to myself, now I know why her staff is having problems. And all I said to her is, I'm certainly going to do my best, because that's all I could do. I don't know what her expectations are. And it's not my job to come up with her expectations. My job is simply to do best. That's why parents should be the message to your kids. Just do your best. Your best, more often than not, is good enough. And if it isn't, that's the way it is. But you didn't do anything wrong. There are plenty of kids who aren't getting into Ivy League schools. And we both know it's the getting in. It's not the level of work. You could take these students at, you know, selective schools, and they could still get through an Ivy League school. They can do the work. It's getting in that is the problem. So there's a lot of A students that have, you know, phenomenal resumes. I mean, the New York Times, I don't know if you saw it many months ago, about the applicants they rejected from Harvard's business school. It was like ridiculous in terms of these people were off the charts and they still didn't get in. They didn't do anything wrong. There's just somebody, in quotes, better. That's a big difference, though, than choking and taking yourself out of the game. Then you never even had a chance. So the idea of performing under pressure is not to rise to the occasion, but it is to perform closest to your capability. And those are in the moment strategies. You know, the long-term strategies that I like to teach people to instill in themselves is what I call your coat of armor: confidence, optimism, tenacity, and enthusiasm. Those are the attributes that allow you to do your best every day. And remember, nobody invented those. Nobody invented optimism, although positive psychologists like to make believe they did. Nobody invented confidence. Nobody invented tenacity. These are evolved mechanisms that work because they help us deal with the adversity, you know, that life throws at us. You know, Tom Brady wins a game in the last minute. Oh, he's so clutch. No, he's the best quarterback. He's the best every Sunday. Everybody forgets the interception he threw at the end of the second half. So, you know, we tend to remember the positive things. But if you are the best, some of those moments that you are the best in will be, quote, pressure moments. It's not a big deal if the A student aces their SATs. That's what they always do. It's not a big deal if a soccer player makes a penalty kick. That's what they all do. It's a big story if he misses the penalty kick. I remember the World Cup a couple of years ago, and I saw one of these kickers miss the penalty kick and so on. It was like, why? That was a story, not the guys who make it. That's what they train for. That's not a big deal. And I like people to remember that. You know, I like people to remember that because it takes pressure off. When you realize you don't have to rise to the occasion, just do your best. That's a different mindset, because if you try to rise to the occasion, then you're pressing, then you're trying too hard.
It's always useful to keep in mind that, you know, even our idols, the people that we consider titans in various different industries, have had serious misses. I mean, these people do not hit home runs every time they step up to the plate. But I think what sets them apart from other people is that they keep pushing. If a book didn't sell well, you know, the next one might. But they focus on the process and they keep pushing forward, even though they know that, look, every now and then you're going to have a miss.
Woody Allen says his only goal when he does a movie is that it makes a dollar. Because if it makes a dollar, he knows he can do another one. I mean, these people don't even know. You know, it's like there's a lot of failures that come out and companies release in every industry, whether it's films, whether it's pharmaceutical drugs. Not everyone is a Prozac. Not everyone is a Viagra. There's a lot of bombs, you know, also. You know, and one of the things I found in terms of successful people is they don't even use the word failure. They use it in terms of setbacks, glitches. Again, they're minimizing significance.
Sure. Yeah, they're just minor blips, if even that.
Yeah, because you know what happens to people who don't minimize the failure? They become clinically depressed, and that becomes a problem. Again, and think of how the world of promoting a concept, it's like resiliency. There's nothing special about the resilient individual, and yet there's so many authors and Oprah shows that make a big deal. Oh, look how resilient the person was. Everybody is resilient. Life is resilient. Look at all the burnings in California, the fires. Let me tell you something. All those trees are growing back. Life is resilient. You get sick. Do you need a pep talk for somebody to come in and tell you the importance of being resilient? Here are the six things you must do to be a resilient personality. Your body is resilient. The story is the people who aren't resilient. That's why depression is an illness. People who are depressed are not necessarily resilient. But this is one of the greatest hypes that psychology, positive psychology in the publishing world has put on to the public, making the public think that there is something special about being resilient. There is nothing special. What is special is if you're not resilient.
I love the message that you mentioned before, which is that life is resilient. Everyone is resilient. And I think that's a great message to end this conversation on. But before we wrap up here, I'd love to give you the opportunity to tell the listeners about where they can find more about you, about your work, your books, and your courses.
Well, thank you. And I would say that the best place is simply to go to my website, which is Hank Weisinger, Weisinger, PhD.com. And one thing I think people will find very interesting is the Performing Under Pressure is now a state-of-the-art online class. And I think that people will really enjoy it. In fact, and I'll send it to you, that anybody who listens to this and goes to the class, I'm going to send you a code that they will only get from your website, which will allow them a 50% discount on the class, and people have lifetime access to it. So I think it's priced at $97. So what I'm saying is, for $50, you can get a class that literally is going to, if you do the class, you know, you do it. And when I say do it, I don't mean just reading it through and looking at the videos once. You have to do the downloads, the exercises. If you do that, it's going to make a big difference in a person's life, not only in terms of performing under pressure, but reducing daily feelings of pressure that so many people have. And let me give one final message that sure. I want people to remember. The first book I wrote was called Nobody's Perfect. Now, I did not come up with that title. My collaborator called me up and said, Hank, I got the title for the book. I said, yeah, what is it? Nobody's Perfect. I said, I like it. It's commercial. I can promote that. But I didn't really know what it means. Now I know. And I think of myself when I say this from when I was 18. We were all in the process of becoming. We were all in the process of evolving. How people were 20 years ago, for the most part, were very different today. We're changing. And, you know, that first book was on criticism. And what I learned is that people with good self-esteem want criticism. Because they care about themselves. They want to do better. You know, most of us think of criticism as being told that you did something wrong, when in reality, it's simply information that can help you do better. When you're writing a book, you'd have to be nuts not to want criticism from a successful editor, because the editor is not telling you what's wrong with your book. What that editor is telling you is how it can be better. I like to encourage people to develop an aggressive attitude for seeking criticism. Not tell me what I'm doing wrong, but always tell me how I can be better. When I was teaching at Wharton, I loved the evaluations because I saw them as information that can help me do the next presentation even more effectively. It's people at the other end of the spectrum who say no way, because these people think of criticism as a negative. When they are criticized, they hear it as, I did something wrong, the other person is right. So they get defensive. And ironically, getting defensive keeps you the same. That's the paradox. The real way to defend yourself is open up and let information. Nobody dies from being, quote, criticized. It might not feel good, but in the long run, you end up feeling better because you've made improvements. So the message that I want to leave everybody is that I found out, especially, you know, in the context of giving and taking criticism, which of all my topics is my favorite, I learned that nobody was perfect at a very early age, because my father for 30 years was the story editor of Superman. And everybody listening knows that not even Superman was perfect. He had one thing that could destroy them. And when I would say that one time to a third grade class, everybody yelled out Lois Lane. And the message that I want people to remember is that when you can start to see criticism as a form of emotional support rather than an emotional attack, then you make yourself and the people you work with and your family, you make people feel like a Superman despite the kryptonite. So that's what I want people to remember.
Oh, I love that. And that's a great way to wrap this conversation up. And thank you for the information on your website and the discount for my listeners. I'll put all of that into the show notes, and so people can have easy access. Thank you so much, Hank. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Me too. Thanks for having me.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for listening. Two things before you take off. First, if you don't want to miss out on future episodes of Famous Failures, please subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you're listening on, and be sure to leave a review on iTunes or Google Play. Second, if you'd like to join thousands of others who receive a short email from me each Thursday with a list of articles, books, tools, quotes, and other gems that help you discover how extraordinary thinking produces extraordinary results, you can text my first name, which is Ozan, that's spelled O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. So once again, that's my first name, Ozan, O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. Or if you're in front of your computer, you can head over to ozanvarol.com and drop your email address. If you act now, you'll also get a free ebook called The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles to Innovate Your Thinking. As always, thank you for listening, and see you next time.